and wriggle the sturdier and larger hollow chicken bone into its place. He didn't laugh this time, either. I plugged the end of the bone neatly and, kneeling in front of Jamie, resumed my stitching on his collarbone. I felt perfectly clear-headed, but in that oddly surreal way that is an indication of total exhaustion. I'd done what had had to be done, but I knew I couldn't stay upright much longer. "What does Captain Hickman have to say?" I asked, much more by way of distracting both of us than because I really wanted to know.
"A great number of things, as you might imagine."
He took a deep breath and fixed his eyes on a huge turtle shell that had been wedged in among the boxes.
"Discarding the purely personal opinions and a certain amount of excessive language, though, we're bound up the Hudson for Fort Ticonderoga."
"We what?" I frowned at the needle pushed halfway through the skin. "Why?" His hands were braced on the deck, fingers pressing into the boards so hard the nails were white.
"That's where he was bound when the complications occurred, and that's where he means to go. He's a gentleman of very fixed views, I find."
A loud snort came from behind the tea-chest. I did notice something of the sort. I tied the last suture and clipped the thread neatly with my knife. "Did you say something, Captain Stebbings?" The snort was repeated, more loudly, but without emendation.
"Can't he be convinced to put us ashore?"
Jamie's fingers hovered over the fresh stitching, obviously wanting to rub the stinging sight, but I pushed them away.
"Aye, well, there are further complications, Sassenach."
"Do tell," I murmured, standing up and stretching.
"Oh, God, my back!
What sort of complications? Do you want some tea?"
"Only if there's a good deal of whiskey in it."
He leaned his head back against the bulkhead, closing his eyes. There was a hint of colour in his cheeks, though his forehead shone with sweat.
"Brandy, do you?"
I needed tea, minus alcohol, badly myself, and headed for the ladder, not waiting for his nod. I saw him reach for the wine bottle as I set foot on the lowest rung. There was a brisk wind blowing up above. It swirled the long cloak out around me as I emerged from the depths, and whooshed up my petticoats in a most revivifying fashion.
It revivified Mr. Smith,
or rather Mr. Marsden, too, who blinked and looked hastily away.
"Evening, ma'am," he said politely when I'd got my assorted garments back under control. "The Colonel doing well, I hope?"
"Yes, he's..." I broke off and gave him a sharp look.
"The Colonel?"
I had a slight sinking sensation.
"Yes'm. He's a militia colonel, isn't he?"
"He was," I said with emphasis. Smith's face broke into a smile.
"No was about it, ma'am," he said. "He's done us the honour to take command of a company. Fraser's Irregulars, we're to be called."
"How apt," I said. "What the devil... How did this happen?" He tugged nervously at one of his earrings, seeing that I perhaps wasn't as pleased by the news as might be hoped.
"Ah, well, to tell the truth, ma'am, I'm afraid it was my fault."
He ducked his head, abashed.
"One of the hands aboard the pit recognised me, and when he told the captain who I was..."
The revelation of Mr. Marston's real name, in combination with his adornments, had caused considerable uproar among the motley crew presently on board the Asp. Sufficiently so that he had been in some danger of being thrown overboard, or set adrift in a boat. After a certain amount of acrimonious discussion, Jamie had suggested that perhaps Mr. Marsden could be persuaded to change his profession and become a soldier, for a number of the hands aboard the Asp had already proposed to leave her and join the Continental Forces at Ticonderoga, portaging the goods and weapons across to Lake Champlain and then remaining as militia volunteers. This found general approbation, though a few disgruntled persons were still heard to mutter that a Jonah was a Jonah, didn't matter if he was a sailor or not. That being why I thought I'd best make myself scarce below, if you see what I mean, ma'am. Mr. Marsden concluded. It also solved the problem of what to do with the imprisoned hands from the pit and the displaced seamen from the Teal. Those who preferred joining the American militia would be allowed to do so, while those British seamen who preferred the prospect of life as prisoners of war could be accommodated in this desire at Fort Ticonderoga. About half the men from the Teal had expressed a decided preference for employment on land after their recent seagoing adventures, and they also would join the irregulars. I see, I said, rubbing two fingers between my brows. Well, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Marsden, I must be going and making a cup of tea. With a lot of brandy in it. The tea heartened me, sufficiently to send Abram, found drowsing by the galley fire in spite of having been ordered to bed, to take some to Jamie and Captain Stebbings while I made the rounds of my other patients. They were mostly as comfortable as might be expected, that is, not very, but stoic about it, and in no need of exigent medical intervention. The temporary strength lent me by tea and brandy had mostly ebbed by the time I made my way back down the ladder into the hold, though, and my foot slipped off the final rung, causing me to drop heavily onto the deck with a thump that elicited a startled cry from Stebbings, followed by a groan. Waving away Jamie's raised brow, I hurried over to check the patient. He was very hot to the touch, his full face flushed, and a nearly full cup of tea lay discarded near him. I tried to make him drink, but he said he couldn't swallow more than a mouthful. Jamie had followed me and spoke softly behind me. I bent and placed my ear near Stebbing's chest, auscultating as best I could through the layer of blubber covering it. The chicken bone tube, momentarily unplugged, gave only a modest hiss of air, and no more than a trace of blood. So far as I can tell, the lungs expanded at least partially, I said, addressing Stebbings for form's sake, though he merely stared at me, glassy-eyed. And I think the bullet must have cauterized a good deal of the damage. Otherwise, I think we'd be seeing much more alarming symptoms. Otherwise he'd be dead by now, but I thought it more tactful not to say so. He might easily be dead soon in any case from fever, but I didn't say that either. I persuaded him to drink some water and sponged his head and torso with more of it. The hatch cover had been left off, and it was reasonably cool in the hold, though the air didn't move much down below. Still, I saw no benefit in taking him into the wind on deck, and the less he was moved, the better.
Is that my cloak? He asked, suddenly opening one eye.
Probably, I replied, disconcerted. Do you want it back? He made a brief grimace and shook his head, then lay back, eyes closed, breathing shallowly. Jamie was propped against the tea-chest, head back, eyes closed, and breathing heavily. Feeling me sit down beside him, though, he raised his head and opened his eyes.
You look as though you're about to fall over, Sassenach, he said softly. Lie down, I'll mind the captain.
I saw his point. In fact, I saw two of them, and him. I blinked and shook my head, momentarily reuniting the two Jamies, but there was no denying that he was right. I'd lost touch with my body again, but my mind, instead of sticking to the job, had simply wandered off somewhere in a daze. I rubbed my hands hard over my face, but it didn't help appreciably. I'll have to sleep, I explained to the men, all four of them now watching me with the perfect wide-eyed attention of barn owls. If you feel the pressure building up again, and I think it will, I said to Stebbings, pull the plug out of the tube until it eases, then put it back. If either of you think you're dying, wake me up. With no further ado, and feeling as though I were watching myself doing it, I eased down onto the planking, put my head on a fold of Stebbing's cloak, and fell asleep. I woke an unaccountable time later and lay for some minutes lacking coherent thought, my mind rising and falling with the movement of the deck beneath me. At some point I began to distinguish the murmur of men's voices from the shush and bang of sea-going noises. I had fallen so deeply into oblivion that the events prior to my falling asleep took a moment to recall, but the voices brought them back. Wounds, the reek of brandy, the rip of sailcloth tearing, rough in my hands, and the smell of the dye in the bright wet calico. Jamie's bloody shirt, the sucking sound of the hole in Stebbing's chest. The memory of that would have brought me upright at once, but I had stiffened from lying on the boards. A sharp twinge of agony lanced from my right knee to my groin, and the muscles of my back and arms hurt amazingly. Before I could stretch them enough to struggle to my feet, I heard the captain's voice.
"Call Hickman."
Stebbing's voice was hoarse and low, but definite.
"I'd rather be shot than do this any more."
I didn't think he was joking. Neither did Jamie.
"I didn't blame you,"
he said. His voice was soft, but serious, as definite as Stebbing's. My eyes were beginning to focus again as the paralyzing ache in my muscles eased a little. From where I lay, I could see Stebbing's from the knees down, and most of Jamie sitting beside him, head bowed on his own knees, tall form slumped against the tea-chest. There was a pause, and then Stebbing's said,
"You don't, eh? Good. Go get Hickman."
"Why?" Jamie asked, after what seemed an equal pause for thought, or perhaps only to gather strength to answer. He didn't lift his head. He sounded almost drugged with fatigue.
"No need to rouse the man from his bed, is there? If you want to die, just pull that thing out of your chest."
Stebbing's made some sort of noise. It might have started as a laugh, a groan, or an angry retort, but ended in a hiss of air between clenched teeth. My body tensed. Had he actually tried to pull it out? No. I heard the heavy movement of his body, saw his feet curl briefly as he sought a more comfortable position, and heard Jamie's grunt as he leaned over to help.
"Someone might as well get satisfaction from me dying,"
he wheezed.
"I put yon hole in you," Jamie pointed out.
He straightened up and stretched with painful care.
"It wouldn't please me overmuch to watch you die from it."
I thought he must be well past the point of exhaustion, and plainly he was as stiff as I was. I must get up and make him go lie down. But he was still talking to Stebbing's, sounding unconcerned, like a man discussing an abstruse point of natural philosophy.
"As for satisfying Captain Hickman, do you feel some sense of obligation toward him?" "I don't."
That one came out short and sharp, though succeeded by a deep gasp for air.
"It's a clean death,"
Stebbing's managed after a few more breaths.
"Quick."
"Aye, that's what I thought," Jamie said, sounding drowsy.
"When it was me."
Stebbing's gave a grunt that might have been interrogative. Jamie sighed. After a moment I heard the rustle of cloth and saw him move his left leg, groaning as he did so, and turn back the cloth of his kilt.
"See that?"
His finger ran slowly up the length of his thigh from just above the knee, almost to the groin. Stebbing's gave a slightly more interested grunt, this one definitely questioning. The drooping toes of his socks moved as his feet twitched.
"Bayonet,"
Jamie said, casually flipping his kilt back over the twisting, runneled scar.
"I lay for 2 days after, with the fever eating me alive. My leg swelled and it stank. And when the English officer came to blow our brains out, I was pleased enough."
A brief silence.
"Culloden?"
Stebbing's asked. His voice was still hoarse, and I could hear the fever in it, but there was interest there now, too.
"Heard about it?"
Jamie said nothing in response, but yawned suddenly, not bothering to smother it, and rubbed his hand slowly over his face. I could hear the soft rasp of beard stubble. Silence. But the quality of it had changed. I could feel Stebbing's anger, his pain and fright, but there was a faint sense of amusement in his laboured breathing.
"Going to make me ask?"
Jamie shook his head.
"Too long a story, and one I dinna care to tell. Leave it that I wanted him to shoot me very badly, and the bastard wouldna do it."
The air in the little hold was stale but uneasy, filled with the shifting scents of blood and luxury, of industry and illness. I breathed in, gently, deep, and could smell the tang of the men's bodies, a sharp, copper, savage smell, bitter with effort and exhaustion. Women never smelled like that, I thought, even in extremity.
"Revenge, then, is it?"
Stebbings asked after a bit. His restless feet had stilled, his dirty stockings drooped, and his voice was tired. Jamie's shoulders moved slowly as he sighed, and his own voice was nearly as tired as Stebbing's.
"No," he said, very softly. "Call it payment of a debt."
"A debt?" I thought. "To whom?" "To the Lord Melton, who had declined to kill him out of honour, who had instead sent him home from Culloden, hidden in a wagon filled with hay. To his sister, who had refused to let him die, who had dragged him back to life by sheer strength of will. Or to those who had died when he had not?" I had stretched myself enough now to be able to rise, but didn't yet. There was no urgency. The men were silent, their breathing part of the breathing of the ship, the sigh of the sea outside. It came to me, quiet but sure, that I knew. I had glimpsed the abyss often over someone's shoulder as they stood on the edge looking down. But I had looked once too. I knew the vastness and the lure of it, the offer of surcease. I knew they were standing now, side by side, and each alone, looking down. Part 4. Conjunction. Chapter 32. A Flurry of Suspicion.
Lord John Grey to Mr. Arthur Norrington. 4th of February, 1777. Cipher 158. "My dear Norrington, pursuant to our conversation, I have made certain discoveries which I think it prudent to confide. I paid a visit to France at the end of the year, and while there visited the Baron Ormondine. I stayed with the Baron for several days, in fact, and had a conversation of him on a number of occasions. I have reason to believe that Beauchamp is indeed concerned in the matter we discussed, and has formed an attachment to Beaumarchais, who is thus likely similarly involved. I think Armandine is not himself concerned, but that Beauchamp may use him as a front of some kind. I requested an audience with Beaumarchais, but was denied. As he would normally have received me, I think I have poked a stick into some nest. It would be useful to watch that quarter. Be also alert to any mention in the French correspondence of a company called Rodrigue Hautalais et Compagnie. I beg you will speak with the person handling the Spanish correspondence as well. I cannot discover anything amiss, but neither can I discover anything solid regarding them, such as the names of the directors, and that in itself strikes me as suspicious. If your duty allow, I should be pleased to hear of anything you learn concerning these matters. Your servant, sir, Lord John Grey. Postscriptum. If you can tell me who is presently in charge of the American department with regard to correspondence. Lord John Grey to Harold, Duke of Pardlow, 4th of February, 1777. Family cipher. How?
I saw Amandine. Wainwright does live at the manor house, a place called Trois Flèches, and does maintain an unwholesome relationship with the Baron. I met the Baron's sister, Wainwright's wife. She certainly knows of the link between her brother and her husband, but does not admit it openly. Beyond that, she appears to know nothing whatever. I have seldom met a more stupid woman. She is openly lewd in manner, and a very bad card player. So is the Baron, by which token I am convinced that he does know something of Wainwright's political machinations. He behaved shiftily when I steered the conversation in that direction, and I am sure he is not schooled in the art of misdirection. He is not stupid, though. Even if he were, he will certainly have told Wainwright of my visit. I have alerted Nonnington to watch for any activity on that front. Knowing what I do of Wainwright's abilities and connections, or rather the lack of them, I cannot quite fathom his involvement. Granted, if the French government does have such schemes in mind as he indicated, they would hardly make open communication regarding them, and sending someone like Wainwright to speak to someone like me might be considered sufficiently sub rosa. Certainly, such an approach has the benefit of being deniable. And yet, something seems wrong in this, in a way I cannot yet define. I will be with you soon, and hope by then to be in possession of some definite information regarding one Captain Ezekiel Richardson, likewise one Captain Dennis Randall Isaacs. Should you be able to investigate either of these names through your own connections, you would greatly oblige your most affectionate brother, John. Postscriptum. I trust your health is mending. Harold, Duke of Pardlow, to Lord John Grey, 6th of March, 1777. Bath. Family cipher. I'm not dead. Wish I were. Bath is vile. I am daily wrapped in canvas and carried off like a parcel to be sunk in boiling water that smells of rotten eggs, then hauled out and forced to drink it. But Minnie says she will divorce me by petition in the House of Lords on the grounds of insanity caused by immoral acts if I don't submit. I doubt this, but here I am. Dennis Randall Isaacs is the son of an Englishwoman named Mary Hawkins and a British Army officer, one Jonathan Wolverton Randall, Captain of Dragoons, deceased, killed at Culloden. The mother is still alive, and married to a Jew named Robert Isaacs, a merchant in Bristol. He's still alive, too, and has a half-interest in a warehouse in Brest. Dennis is one of your damned politicals, got ties to Germain, but I can't find out more than that without being too overt for your tastes. Can't find out anything in bloody Bath. Don't know much about Richardson, but we'll find out directly. Sent letters to some people in America. Yes, I am discreet, thank you. And so are they. John Burgoyne is here, taking the cure. Very cock-a-hoop, as Germain has approved his scheme to invade from Canada. I have mentioned William to him, as his French and German are good, and Burgoyne is to have a number of Brunswickers. Still, tell Willie to be careful. Burgoyne seems to think he is to be commander-in-chief of the army in America, a notion that I dare say will come as rather a surprise to both Guy Carleton and Dick Howe. Trois Flèches. Three arrows. Who is the third? London, March the 26th, 1777. The Society for the Appreciation of the English Beefsteak, a gentleman's club. Who is the third? Grey repeated in astonishment, staring at the note he had just opened. The third what? Harry Quarry handed his sopping cloak to the steward and sank heavily into the chair beside Grey's, sighing with relief as he held his hands out to the fire. God's teeth, I'm frozen solid. You're going to Southampton in this? He flung one big, cold-blanched hand at the window, which framed a dismal prospect of icy sleet, driven almost horizontal by the wind. Not till tomorrow. It may have cleared by then. Harry gave the window a look of deep suspicion and shook his head. Not a chance. Steward! Mr. Bodley was already tottering toward them under the weight of a tea tray laden with seed cake, sponge cake, strawberry jam, marmalade, hot buttered crumpets in a basket wrapped in white linen, scones, clotted cream, almond biscuits, sardines on toast, a pot of beans baked with bacon and onion, a plate of sliced ham with gherkins, a bottle of brandy with two glasses and, perhaps as an afterthought, a steaming teapot with two china cups and saucers alongside.
"Ah," said Harry, looking happier, "I see you expected me."
Gray smiled. If not on campaign or called away by duty, Harry Quarry invariably entered the beefsteak at 4:30 on a Wednesday.
"I thought you'd need sustenance with Hal on the sick list."
Harry was one of the two regimental colonels, as distinct from Hal, who was colonel of the regiment, it being his own regiment. Not all colonels took an active hand in the operations of their regiments, but Hal did.
"Malingering bugger," Harry said, reaching for the brandy. "How is he?" "Quite his usual self, to judge from his correspondence."
Gray handed Quarry the unfolded letter, which the latter read with a burgeoning grin.
"Aye, Minnie will have him sorted out like a hand of whist."
He put down the letter, nodding at it as he raised his glass.
"Who's Richardson, and why do you want to know about him?"
"Ezekiel Richardson, captain. Lancers, but detached for intelligence work."
"Oh, intelligence laddie, eh? One of your black chamber lot?"
Quarry wrinkled his nose, though it wasn't clear whether this was a response to the notion of intelligence laddies or the presence of a dish of grated horseradish accompanying the sardines.
"No, I don't know the man well personally," Gray admitted, and felt the same pang of deep unease that had been afflicting him with increased frequency ever since his receipt of William's letter from Quebec a week before.
"I had been introduced to him by Sir George, who knew his father, but we didn't talk much on that occasion. I had heard a few things to his credit, in a quiet sort of way. That being, I suppose, the only way one wants to hear anything about a man in that line of business."
Harry drew a tremendous gasp of air through his open mouth and up into his sinuses by the sound of it, then coughed once or twice, eyes watering, and shook his head in admiration.
"Fresh horseradish," he croaked, taking another large spoonful. "Very fresh."
"Quite. Anyway, I met him again in North Carolina. We talked a bit more, and he asked my permission to approach William with a proposition regarding intelligencing."
Quarry stopped, a slice of sardine-laden toast halfway to his mouth.
"You don't mean to say you've let him lure Willie off into the weeds?"
"That was certainly not my intent," Gray said, nettled. "I had some reason to feel that the suggestion would be good for Willie. For one thing, it would get him out of North Carolina and end with him attached to Howe's staff."
Quarry nodded, masticating with care, and swallowed thickly.
"Aye, right. But now you have doubts?"
"I do. The more so because I can find very few people who actually know Richardson well. Everyone who recommended him to me in the first place did so by reason of someone else's recommendation, it seems. Except for Sir George Stanley, who is presently in Spain with my mother, and old Nigel Bruce, who's rather inconveniently died in the meantime."
"Thoughtless."
"Yes. I imagine I could root out more information had I time, but I haven't. Dotty and I sail day after tomorrow.
Weather permitting,"
he added, with a glance at the window.
"Ah, this would be where I come in,"
Harry observed without animus.
"What shall I do with any information I find? Tell Hal or send it to you?"
"Tell Hal," Gray said with a sigh. "God knows what this post may be like in America, even with the Congress sitting in Philadelphia. If anything seems urgent, Hal can expedite matters here far more easily than I can there."
Quarry nodded and refilled Gray's glass.
"You're not eating," he observed. "I lunched late."
"Quite late. In fact, he hadn't had luncheon yet." He took a scone and spread it desultorily with jam.
"And Dennis, what's name?"
Quarry asked, flicking the letter with a pickle fork.
Shall I inquire about him too?
By all means, though I may make better progress with him on the American end of the matter. That's at least where he was last seen.
He took a bite of scone, observing that it had achieved that delicate balance between crumbliness and half-set mortar that is the ideal of every scone, and felt some stirrings of appetite return. He wondered whether he should put Harry onto the worthy Jew with a warehouse in Brest, but decided not. The question of French connections was more than delicate, and while Harry was thorough, he wasn't subtle.
Right then.
Harry selected a slice of sponge cake, topped it with two almond biscuits and a dollop of clotted cream, and inserted the whole into his mouth.
Where did he put it? Grey wondered.
Harry was thick-set and burly, but never stout. No doubt he sweated it off during energetic exercise in brothels, that being his favourite sport, despite advancing age.
How old was Harry? He wondered suddenly.
A few years older than Grey, a few years younger than Hal. He'd never thought about it, no more than he had with reference to Hal. The two of them had always seemed immortal. He had never once contemplated a future lacking either one of them. But the skull beneath Harry's wig was nearly hairless now. He had, in his usual way, removed it to scratch his head at some point, and set it casually back without regard to straightness, and the joints of his fingers were swollen, though he handled his teacup with his usual delicacy. Grave felt of a sudden his own mortality, in the stiffening of a thumb, the twinge of a knee. Most of all, in the fear that he might not be there to protect William, while he was still needed.
Eh?
Said Harry, raising a brow at whatever showed on Grey's face.
What?
Grey smiled and shook his head, taking up his brandy glass once more.
Timor mortis conturbat me, he said.
Ah,
said Quarry thoughtfully, and raised his own.
I'll drink to that.
Chapter 33. The Plot Thickens. 28th of February, A.D., 1777, London.
Major General John Burgoyne to Sir George Germain. I do not conceive any expedition from the sea can be so formidable to the enemy, or so effectual to close the war, as an invasion from Canada by Ticonderoga.
April the 4th, 1777, on board HMS Tartar. He'd told Dotty that the Tartar was only a 28-gun frigate, and that she must therefore be modest in her packing. Even so, he was surprised to see the single trunk, granted a large one, two portmanteaus, and a bag of needlework that comprised her entire luggage.
What? Not a single flowered mantua? He teased. William won't know you.
Bosh, she replied, with her father's talent for succinct clarity. But she smiled a little. She was very pale, and he hoped it wasn't incipient seasickness. And he squeezed her hand, and went on holding it all the time until the last dark sliver of England sank into the sea. He was still amazed that she'd managed it. Hal must be more frail than he'd let on, to be bamboozled into allowing his daughter to take ship for America, even under Grey's protection, and for the laudable purpose of nursing her wounded brother. Minnie, of course, would not be parted from Hal for a moment, though naturally worried sick for her son. But that she had uttered no word of protest at this adventure.
"Your mother's in on it, is she?"
he asked casually, provoking a startled look through a veil of wind-blown hair.
On what?
Dotty pawed at the blonde spider-web of her hair escaped en masse from the inconsequent snood in which she'd bound it, and dancing over her head like flames.
Oh, help!
He captured her hair, smoothing it tight to her head with both hands, then gathering it at her neck, where he plaited it expertly to the admiration of a passing seaman, clubbed it, and tied it up with a velvet ribbon that was all that remained from the wreck of her snood.
On what, forsooth?
He told the back of her head as he finished the job.
on whatever the dreadful enterprise is on which you've embarked.
She turned round and faced him, her stare direct. If you want to describe rescuing Henry as a dreadful enterprise, I agree entirely, she said with dignity. But my mother would naturally do anything she could to get him back. So would you, presumably, or you wouldn't be here. And without waiting for a reply, she turned smartly on her heel and made for the companionway, leaving him speechless. One of the first ships of the spring had brought a letter with further word of Henry. He was still alive, thank God, but had been badly wounded, shot in the abdomen, and very ill in consequence through the brutal winter. He had survived, though, and been moved to Philadelphia with a number of other British prisoners. The letter had been written by a fellow officer there, another prisoner, but Henry had managed to scribble a few words of love to his family at the bottom and sign his name. The memory of that straggling scrawl ate at John's heart. He was encouraged somewhat by the fact that it was Philadelphia, though. He had met a prominent Philadelphian while he was in France and had formed an immediate liking for him that he thought was returned. There might be something of use in the acquaintance. He grinned involuntarily, recalling the instant of his meeting with the American gentleman. He hadn't paused long in Paris, only long enough to make inquiries after Percival Beauchamp, who was not there. Retired to his home in the country for the winter, he was told. The Beauchamp family's main estate, a place called Trois Flèches, near Compiègne. And so he had bought a fur-lined hat and a pair of sea boots, wrapped himself in his warmest cloak, hired a horse, and set grimly off into the teeth of a howling gale. Arriving mud-caked and frozen, he had been greeted with suspicion, but the quality of his accoutrements and his title had gained him entrance, and he had been shown to a well-appointed parlour with, thank God, an excellent fire, to await the Baron's pleasure. He'd formed an expectation of the Baron Ormondine on the basis of Percy's remarks, though he thought Percy had likely been practising upon him. He also knew how futile it was to theorise in advance of observation, but it was inhuman not to imagine. In terms of imagining, he'd done a good job of not thinking of Percy during the last, was it 18 years? 19? But once it became obvious that thinking of him was now a professional as well as a personal necessity, he was both surprised and disconcerted to find just how much he remembered. He knew what Percy liked, and therefore had evolved a mental picture of Amandine in accordance. The reality was different. The Baron was an older man, perhaps a few years Grey's senior, short and rather plump, with an open, pleasant face. Well-dressed, but without ostentation. He greeted Grey with great courtesy, but then he took Grey's hand, and a small electric shock ran through the Englishman. The Baron's expression was civil, no more, but the eyes held a look of interest and avidity, and despite the Baron's unprepossessing appearance, Grey's flesh answered the look. Of course, Percy had told Amandine about him. Surprised and wary, he gave the brief explanation he had prepared, only to be informed that, Ella, Monsieur Beauchamp was not at home, but had gone with Monsieur Beaumarchais to hunt wolves in Alsace. Well, that was one supposition confirmed, Grey thought. But surely his lordship would condescend to accept the hospitality of Trois Flèches for the night at least. He accepted this invitation with many expressions of unworthy thanks, and having doffed his outer clothes and replaced his sea boots with Dotty's garish carpet slippers, which made Amandine blink, though he at once praised them exceedingly, he was propelled down a long corridor lined with portraits.
"We will take some refreshment in the library," Amandine was saying. "Plainly you are perishing of cold and inanition. But if you do not mind, allow me to introduce you en route to my other guest. We will invite him to join us."
Grey had murmured acquiescence, distracted by the light pressure of Amandine's hand which rested on his back, slightly lower than was usual.
"He is an American," the Baron was saying as they reached a door toward the end of the corridor,
and his voice conveyed considerable in the way of amusement in that word. He had a most unusual voice, soft, warm, and somewhat smoky, like oolong tea with a lot of sugar.
"He enjoys to spend some time each day in the solar," the Baron went on, pushing open the door and gesturing grey ahead of him. "He says it keeps him in a state of robust health."
Grey had been looking politely at the Baron during this introduction, but now turned to speak to the American guest, and so was introduced to Dr. Franklin, reclining comfortably in a padded chair, lit by a flood of sunlight, stark naked. In the subsequent conversation, conducted with the greatest aplomb on the part of all parties, he learned that it was Dr. Franklin's invariant practice to bathe in air every day when possible, as skin breathed quite as much as did lungs, taking in air and releasing impurities. Thus, the ability of the body to defend itself from infection was substantially impaired if the skin were constantly suffocated in insanitary clothing. Throughout the introductions and conversation, Grey was acutely aware of Amandine's eyes upon him, full of speculation and amusement, and of the cumbersome feel of his own insanitary clothing upon his doubtless suffocating skin. It was an odd feeling to meet a stranger, and know that said stranger was already privy to his deepest secret, that he, in fact, if Percy were not altogether lying, and Grey didn't think he had been, shared it. It gave him a feeling of danger and vertigo, as though he leaned out from some sharp precipice. It also bloody excited him, and that alarmed him very much. The American, now speaking pleasantly about an unusual geological formation he had seen on his journey from Paris, had his lordship noticed it, was an elderly man, and his body, while in fair condition, aside from patches of some purplish eczema about the lower limbs, was not an object of sexual consideration. Nonetheless, Grey's flesh was tight on his bones, and not enough of his blood was in his head. He could feel Amandine's eyes on him, frankly evaluating him, and recalled all too clearly the exchange with Percy regarding Percy's wife and his brother-in-law, the Baron. "Both, on occasion, together? Had the Baron's sister accompanied her husband, or was she perhaps at home?" For one of the few times in his life, Grey wondered seriously whether he might be a pervert.
"Shall we join the good doctor in his beneficial practice, my lord?"
Grey jerked his eyes away from Franklin to see the Baron beginning to peel off his coat. Fortunately, before he could think of anything to say, Franklin rose, remarking that he felt he had had sufficient benefit for the day.
"Though, of course," he said, meeting Grey's eyes directly with an expression of the deepest interest, and not a little amusement too, "you must not allow my departure to prevent your own indulgence, monsieur."
The Baron, impeccably polite, at once resumed his coat, and saying he would join them for un apéritif in the library, disappeared into the corridor. Franklin had a silk dressing gown. Grey held it for him, watching the white, slightly sagging but remarkably firm and unwrinkled buttocks disappear, as the American slowly worked his arms into the sleeves, remarking as he did so upon a touch of arthritis in his shoulder joints. Turning and tying the sash, he fixed an open grey gaze upon Grey.
"Thank you, my lord," he said. "I take it you were not previously acquainted with Amandine?"
"No, I knew his brother-in-law, Monsieur Beauchamp, some years ago, in England," he added, for no particular reason.
Something flickered in Franklin's eyes at the name Beauchamp, causing Grey to ask,
"You know him?"
"I know the name," Franklin replied equably.
"Is Beauchamp an Englishman, then?"
A number of astonishing possibilities had flashed through Grey's mind at that simple remark.
"I know the name."
But an equally rapid evaluation of them decided him upon the truth as safest, and he merely said, "Yes," in a tone indicating that this was simple fact, no more. Over the next few days, he and Franklin had had a number of interesting conversations in which the name of Percy Beauchamp was conspicuous by its absence. When Franklin returned to Paris, though, Grey was left both with a genuine liking for the elderly gentleman, who, upon learning that Grey was bound for the colonies in the spring, had insisted upon giving him letters of introduction to several friends there, and a conviction that Dr. Franklin knew precisely what Percy Beauchamp was and had been.
"Beg pardon, sir," said one of the Tartar's hands, elbowing Grey ungently out of the way and breaking his reverie.
He blinked, coming back to find that his ungloved hands had turned to ice in the wind and his cheeks were numb. Leaving the sailors to their freezing task, he went below, feeling a peculiar small and shameful warmth at the memory of his visit to Trois Flèches.
3rd of May, 1777, New York. Dear Papa, I have just received your letter about Cousin Henry and hope very much that you will be able to discover his whereabouts and obtain his release. If I can hear anything of him, I will do my best to let you know. Is there anyone to whom I should address letters to you in the colonies? If I hear of no alternative, I shall send them in care of Mr. Sanders in Philadelphia, with a copy for safety to Judge O'Keefe in Richmond. I hope you will excuse my own sad delinquency in corresponding. It does not, alas, stem from any press of urgent activity on my part, but rather from ennui and lack of anything of interest about which to write. After a tedious winter immured in Quebec, though I did considerable hunting and shot a very vicious thing called a glutton, I finally received my new orders from General Howe's aide-de-camp in late March, when son of Sir Guy's people came back to the citadel, and I returned to New York in consequence of them. I never received any word from Captain Randall Isaacs, nor have I been able to hear anything of him since my return. I fear very much that he may have been lost in the blizzard. If you know his people, perhaps you would send them a note with my hopes for his survival. I would do so myself, say that I'm not sure where to find them, nor how to phrase my sentiments delicately, in case they are also in doubt of his fate, or worse, are not in doubt. You will know what to say, though. You always do. I was somewhat luckier in my own travels, having suffered only minor shipwreck on my way downriver. We came to grief during the portage at Ticonderoga, being fired upon by a party of American sharpshooters from the fort. No one was harmed, but the canoes were peppered with shot, and some holes were unfortunately not discovered before we put back into the water, whereupon two of them sank abruptly. This followed by waist-deep mud and the re-emergence of carnivorous insects when I took to the roads. Since my return, though, we have done little of interest, though there are constant rumours of what we may do. Finding that inactivity chafes more in what you may call a civilised setting, though none of the girls in New York can dance at all, I volunteered to ride dispatches, and have found some relief in that. Yesterday, however, I received orders sending me back to Canada, there to join General Burgoyne's staff. Do I detect your fine Italian hand in this, Papa? If so, thank you. Also, I have seen Captain Richardson again. He came to my rooms last night. I had not seen him for nearly a year and was much surprised. He did not ask for an account of our journey into Quebec. Not surprising, as the information would be sadly out of date by now. And when I asked after Randall Isaacs, only shook his head and said he didn't know. He had heard I had an errand to carry special dispatches to Virginia before going to Canada, and while, of course, nothing must delay me in that errand, had thought of asking me to do a small service for him as I returned northward. Somewhat wary, as a result of my long sojourn in the frozen north, I asked what this might be, and was told that it was no more than the delivery of a cipher message to a group of loyalist gentlemen in Virginia, something that would be simple for me, owing to my familiarity with the terrain. The job would not delay me more than a day or two, he assured me. I said I would do it,
but more because I should like to see some parts of Virginia that I remember with fondness than because I should like to oblige Captain Richardson. I am somewhat wary of him. Godspeed your travels, Papa, and please give my love to my precious Dotty, whom I long to see. Tell her I shot 42 ermine in Canada. She shall have a cloak made of the skins. Your most affectionate reprobate, William. Chapter 34. Psalms 30. October the 6th, 1980. Lallybroch. Brianna's arrangement with the hydroelectric board provided for her working 3 days a week doing site inspections, overseeing maintenance and repair operations as required, but allowed her to stay at home doing reports, forms, and other paperwork the other 2 days. She was trying to decipher Rob Cameron's notes regarding the power feed from the second turbine at Loch Erechty, which appeared to have been written with grease pencil on the remains of the bag that had held his lunch, when she became aware of sounds in the laird's study across the hall. She'd been vaguely conscious of a low humming for some time, but insofar as she'd noticed the sound, had put it down to a fly trapped by the window. The hum had now acquired words, though, and a fly would not have been singing "The King of Love, My Shepherd Is" to the tune of St. Columba. She froze, realizing that she'd recognized the tune. The voice was rough as coarse grit sandpaper, and it cracked now and then. But it went up, and it went down. And it was, it really was, a song. The song stopped abruptly in a fit of coughing, but after some heavy-duty throat-clearing and cautious humming, the voice started up again, this time using an old Scottish tune she thought was called Crimond. "The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leadeth me the quiet waters by." The quiet waters by was repeated once or twice in different keys, and then, with increased vigour, the hymn went on. "My soul he doth restore again, and me to walk doth make within the paths of righteousness, even for his name's own sake." She sat at her desk, shaking, tears running down her cheeks, and a handkerchief pressed to her mouth so he wouldn't hear. "Thank you," she whispered into its folds. "Oh, thank you." The singing stopped, but the humming resumed, deep and contented. She got herself back under control and wiped the tears hastily away. It was nearly noon. He'd be coming in any time to ask if she was ready for lunch. Roger had had considerable doubt about the assistant choirmaster's position. Doubt he'd tried not to let her see, and doubt she'd shared until he came home to tell her he'd been given the children's choir as his main responsibility. Her own doubt had flown then. Children were at once totally uninhibited about voicing the sorts of remarks regarding social oddity that their elders never would, and entirely accepting of such oddity once they got used to it. "How long did it take them to ask about your scar?" she'd asked, when he'd come home smiling from his first solo practice with the kids. "I didn't time it, but maybe 30 seconds. He rubbed two fingers lightly over the ragged mark across his throat, but didn't stop smiling. "Please, Mr. Mackenzie, what's happened to your neck? Was you hang it?"
"And what did you tell them?"
"Told them I was hang it in America, but I lived, praise God. And a couple of them had elder siblings who'd seen High Plains Drifter and told them about it, so that raised my stock a good bit. I think they expect me to wear my 6 guns to the next practice, though, now the secret's out."
He gave her a Clint Eastwood one-eyed squint, which had made her burst out laughing.
She laughed now, remembering it, and just in time, for Roger stuck his head in, saying,
"How many different versions of the 23rd Psalm would you say there are, set to music?"
23, she guessed, rising.
"Only 6 in the Presbyterian hymnal," he admitted. "But there are metrical settings for it, in English, I mean, that go back to 1546. There's one in the Bay Psalm book and another in the old Scottish Psalter and any number of others here and there. I've seen the Hebrew version too, but I think I'd best not try that one on the St. Stephen's congregation." "Do the Catholics have a musical setting?"
"Catholics have a musical setting for everything," she told him, lifting her nose to sniff for indications of lunch from the kitchen. "But psalms we usually sing to a chant setting. I know 4 different Gregorian chant forms," she informed him loftily, "but there are lots more."
"Yeah? Chant it for me," he demanded,
and stopped dead in the corridor while she hastily tried to recall the words to the 23rd Psalm. The simplest chant form came back automatically. She'd sung it so often in childhood that it was part of her bones.
"That's really something," he said, appreciative, when she'd finished. "Go through it a time or two with me later. I'd like to do it for the kids, just for them to hear. I think they could do Gregorian chant really well."
The kitchen door burst open, and Mandy scampered out, clutching Mr. Polly, a stuffed creature who had started out life as a bird of some kind, but now resembled a grubby terry cloth bag with wings.
"Soup, Mama," she shouted. "Come eat soup."
And soup they ate. Campbell's chicken noodle made from the can, and cheese sandwiches and pickles to fill the cracks. Annie MacDonald was not a fancy cook, but everything she made was edible, and that was saying a good deal, Brianna thought, with memories of other meals eaten around dying fires on soggy mountaintops, or scraped as burnt offerings out of an ashy hearth. She cast a glance of deep affection at the gas-fired Aga cooker that kept the kitchen the coziest room in the house.
"Sing me, Daddy."
Mandy, teeth coated in cheese and mustard round her mouth, gave Roger an entreating grin. Roger coughed on a crumb and cleared his throat.
"Oh, aye. Sing what?"
"3 Blind Mice."
"All right. You'll need to sing with me, though. Keep me from getting off."
He smiled at Mandy and beat time softly on the table with the handle of his spoon.
3 blind mice," he sang,
and pointed the handle at Mandy, who drew a heroic breath and echoed,
3 blind mice,"
at the top of her lungs, but with perfect rhythm. Roger raised his eyebrows at Bree and continued the song in the same counterpoint fashion. After 5 or 6 rousing repetitions, Mandy, tired of it, and with a brief,
"Excuse me,"
rose from the table and took off like a low-flying bumblebee, caroming off the door jamb on her way out.
"Well, she's got a definite sense of rhythm," Roger said, wincing as a loud thud echoed back from the corridor, "if not of coordination. Be a little while before we know if she's got any pitch, though. Your da had a great sense of rhythm, but he couldn't hit the same note twice."
"That reminded me of a bit of what you used to do on the ridge," she said on impulse, "singing a line of a psalm and having the people answer it back." His face changed a little at mention of that time. He'd come newly to his vocation then, and the certainty of it had transformed him. She'd never seen him so happy before or since, and her heart turned over at the flash of longing she saw in his eyes. He smiled, though, and reaching out a napkin-covered finger, wiped a smear of mustard from beside her own mouth.
"Old-fashioned," he said, "though they still do it that way, the line-singing in Kirk, on the Isles, and maybe in the remoter bits of the Gaeltacht. The American Presbyterians won't have it, though."
"They won't?"
"It is proper to sing without parcelling out the psalm line by line," he quoted. "A practice of reading the psalm line by line was introduced in times of ignorance, when many in the congregation could not read. Therefore,
It is recommended that it be laid aside, so far as convenient. That's from the Constitution of the American Presbyterian Church.
Oh, so you did think about being ordained while we were in Boston, she thought, but didn't say aloud. Times of ignorance, she repeated instead. I'd like to know what Hiram Crombie would have had to say to that. He laughed, but shook his head.
Well, it's true enough. Most of the folk on the ridge couldn't read. But I disagree with the notion that you'd only sing the psalms that way because of ignorance or lack of books.
He paused for thought, idly scraping up a stray noodle and eating it.
Singing altogether, that's grand, no doubt about it. But to do it in that back and forth way, I think there's maybe something about it that draws the people closer, makes them feel more involved in what they're singing, what's truly happening. Maybe it's only because they've got to concentrate harder to remember each line.
He smiled briefly and looked away.
Please, she thought passionately, whether to God, the Blessed Virgin, Roger's guardian angel, or all three. You've got to let him find a way. I meant to ask you something, he said, suddenly diffident. What's that? Well, Jimmy, he can sing. Would you... Of course he'd go to Mass with you still. But would you mind if he was to come along with me as well? Only if he liked, he added hastily. But I think he might enjoy being in the choir. And I'd like him to see I have a job too, I suppose, he added with a half-rueful smile.
He'd love that, Brianna said, remarking mentally to the heavenly host.
Well, that was fast.
Because she saw at once, and wondered whether Roger had, but she didn't think so, that this offered a graceful way by which she and Mandy could attend the Presbyterian services as well, without any overt conflict between their two faiths.
Would you come with us to the early Mass at St. Mary's? She asked. Because then we could all just go across to St. Stephen's together and see you and Jem sing. Yes, of course.
He stopped, the sandwich halfway to his mouth, and smiled at her, his eyes green as moss.
It's better, isn't it? He said. Lots, she said.
Later in the afternoon, Roger called her across to the study. There was a map of Scotland laid on his desk, next to the open notebook in which he was compiling the thing they had taken to calling, with a jokiness that barely covered the aversion they felt in even talking about it, The Hitchhiker's Guide, after the BBC radio comedy.
Sorry to interrupt, he said, but I thought we'd best do it before Jem comes home. If you're going back to Loch Erchty tomorrow...
He put the point of his pencil on the blue blotch labelled L. Erchty.
You could maybe get an accurate bearing for the tunnel, if you're not quite sure where it is. Or are you?
She swallowed, feeling the remains of her cheese sandwich stir uneasily at the memory of the dark tunnel, the rocking of the little train, of passing through... it.
I don't, but I have something better. Wait!
She stepped across to her own office and brought back the binder of Loch Erchty's specs. Here are the drawings for the tunnel construction, she said, flipping the binder open and laying it on the desk. I have the blueprints too, but they're at the main office.
No, this is great, he assured her, poring over the drawing. All I really wanted is the compass orientation of the tunnel to the dam.
He glanced up at her.
Speaking of that, have you been all across the dam itself?
Not all across, she said slowly, just the east side of the servicing bay. But I don't think... I mean, look. She put a finger on the drawing. I hit it somewhere in the middle of the tunnel, and the tunnel is nearly in a straight line with the dam. If it runs in a line, is that what you think it does? She added, looking at him curiously. He shrugged.
It's a place to start, though I suppose engineers would have a better sounding word than guess.
Working hypothesis, she said dryly. Anyway, if it does run in a line rather than just existing in random spots, I'd probably have felt it in the dam if it was there at all. But I could go back and check. Even she could hear the reluctance in her voice. He certainly did, and ran a light hand down her back in reassurance.
No, I'll do it.
What?
I'll do it, he repeated mildly. We'll see if I feel it too.
No. She straightened up abruptly. You can't. You don't... I mean, what if something happens? You can't take that kind of risk. He looked at her thoughtfully for a moment and nodded.
Aye, I suppose there's something of a risk, but small. I've been all over the Highlands, Ken, in my younger years, and now and again I've felt something queer pass through me. So have most folk who live here, he added with a smile. Queerness is part of the place, aye?
Yes, she said, with a brief shudder at the thought of water horses, banshee, and knucklevies. But you know what sort of queerness this is. And you know damned well it can kill you, Roger.
Didn't kill you, he pointed out. Didn't kill us on Ocracoke.
He spoke lightly, but she could see the shadow of that journey on his face with the speaking. It hadn't killed them, but it had come close.
No, but...
She looked at him, and had a deep, wrenching instant in which she experienced at once the feel of his long, warm body next to hers in bed, the sound of his deep, corncrake voice, and the cold silence of his absence.
No,
she said, and made it apparent by her tone that she was prepared to be as stubborn as necessary about it. He heard that, and gave a mild snort.
All right, he said. Let me just put it down, then.
Comparing drawing and map, he chose a spot on the map that might correspond roughly with the centre of the tunnel, and raised one dark eyebrow in question. She nodded, and he made a light pencil mark in the shape of a star. There was a large, definite star, made in black ink, over the site of the stone circle on Craigna Doon. Smaller ones in light pencil at the sites of other stone circles. Some day they might have to visit those circles, but not yet. Not now.
Ever been to Lewis?
Roger asked, casually, but not as though it were an idle question. No. Why? She said warily.
The Outer Hebrides are part of the Gaeltacht, he said. They do the line singing in the Gaelic. On Lewis and on Harris, too. Don't know about Uist and Barra. They're mostly Catholic. But maybe. I'm thinking I'd like to go and see what it's like these days.
She could see the Isle of Lewis on the map, shaped like a pancreas, off the west coast of Scotland. It was a large map, large enough for her to see the small legend Callanish Stones on the Isle of Lewis. She exhaled slowly.
Fine, she said. I'll go with you. You've got work, haven't you?
I'll take time off. They looked at each other in silence for a moment. Brianna broke away first, glancing at the clock on the shelf. Jem'll be home soon, she said, the prosaic nature of daily life asserting itself. I'd best start something for supper. Annie brought us a nice salmon that her husband took. Shall I marinate it and bake it, or would you like it grilled? He shook his head, and rising, began to fold the map away.
I won't be in to supper tonight. It's lodge night.
The provincial Grand Masonic Lodge of Inverness-shire included a number of local lodges, two of them in Inverness. Roger had joined Number 6, the old Inverness Lodge, in his early 20s, but had not set foot inside the building in 15 years, and did so now with a mingled sense of wariness and anticipation. It was, though, the Highlands and home.
The first person he saw upon walking in was Barney Goff, who had been the burly, smiling station agent when Roger had come to Inverness on the train, aged 5, to live with his great-uncle. Mr. Goff had shrunk considerably, and his tobacco-stained teeth had long since been replaced by equally tobacco-stained dentures. But he recognised Roger at once, and beamed in delight, seizing him by the arm and towing him into a group of other old men, half of whom likewise exclaimed over his return. It was weird, he thought a bit later, as they settled to the business of the lodge, doing the routine rituals of the Scottish rite. Like a time warp, he thought, and nearly laughed out loud. There were differences, aye, but they were slight. And the feeling of it. He could close his eyes, and if he imagined the haze of stubbed-out cigarettes to be the smoke of a hearth, it could be the Crombies' cabin on the ridge, where the lodge there had met. The close murmur of voices, line and response, and then the relaxation, the shifting of bodies, fetching of tea and coffee as the evening became purely social. There were a good many present, many more than he was used to, and he didn't at first notice Lionel Mingus. The headmaster was across the room, frowning in concentration, listening to something a tall bloke in shirt sleeves was saying to him, leaning close. Roger hesitated, not wanting to break in upon their conversation. But the man talking to Mingus glanced up, saw Roger, returned to his conversation, but then stopped abruptly, gaze jerking back to Roger. To his throat, specifically. Everyone in Lodge had stared at the scar, whether openly or covertly. He'd worn an open-collared shirt under his jacket. There was no point in trying to hide it. Better to get it over with. The stranger stared at the scar so openly, though, as almost to be offensive. Mingus noticed his companion's inattention. He could hardly not. And turning, saw Roger and broke into a smile. "Mr. Mackenzie," he said.
"Roger,"
Roger said, smiling. First names were usual in Lodge when they weren't being formally brother so-and-so. Mingus nodded and tilted his head, drawing his companion into introduction.
"Rob Cameron, Roger Mackenzie. Rob's my cousin. Roger's one of my parents."
"I thought so," Cameron said, shaking him warmly by the hand. "Thought you must be the new choirmaster, I mean. My wee nephew's in your infant's choir. That'll be Bobby Hurra. He told us all about you over supper last week." Roger had seen the private glance exchanged between the men as Mingus introduced him, and thought that the headmaster must also have mentioned him to Cameron, likely telling him about his visit to the school following Jem's Gaelic incident. That didn't concern him at the moment, though.
"Rob Cameron,"
he repeated, giving the man's hand a slightly stronger squeeze than usual before releasing it, this causing him to look startled.
"You worked for the Hydro, do you?" "Aye, what? You'll ken my wife, I think."
Roger bared his teeth in what might, or might not, be taken for a genial smile.
"Brianna Mackenzie?"
Cameron's mouth opened, but no sound came out. He realised this and closed it abruptly, coughing.
Sure.
Roger had sized the man up automatically as he'd grasped his hand, and knew if it came to a fight, it'd be a short one. Evidently, Cameron knew it too.
She told me, aye. Hey, it was no but a wee joke, right?
Cameron eyed him warily in case Roger meant to invite him to step outside.
"Rob?" said Mingus curiously. What's this?
Cried old Barney, bustling up to them.
"Nay politics in Lodge, lad. You want to talk your SNP shite to brother Roger? Take it round to the pub later."
Seizing Cameron by the elbow, Barney towed him off to another group across the room, where Cameron at once settled into conversation with no more than a brief glance back at Roger.
"SNP shite?"
Roger asked, brows raised at Mingus. The headmaster lifted one shoulder, smiling.
"Ken what old Barney said, Nay politics in lodge.
It was a Masonic rule, one of the most basic. No discussion of religion or politics in lodge, and probably the reason Freemasonry had lasted as long as it had, Roger thought. He didn't care much about the Scottish National Party, but he did want to know about Cameron.
Wouldn't dream of it, Roger said. Our Rob's a political, though, is he? My apologies, Brother Roger, Mingus said.
The look of humorous good nature hadn't deserted him, but he did look somewhat apologetic. I didn't mean to expose your family's business, but I did tell my wife about Jem and Mrs. Glendenning, and women being what they are, and my wife's sister living next door to Rob.
Rob got to hear about it. He was interested because of the Gaelic, eh? And he does get carried away a bit. But I'm sure he didn't mean to be seeming too familiar with your wife.
It dawned on Roger that Mingus had hold of the wrong end of the stick regarding Rob Cameron and Brianna, but he didn't mean to enlighten him. It wasn't only the women. Gossip was a way of life in the Highlands, and if word got round about the trick Rob and his mates had played on Bree, it might cause more trouble for her at work.
Ah, he said, seeking for a way to steer the conversation away from Brianna. Of course, the SNP's all for resurrecting the Gaelic, aren't they? Does Cameron have it himself?
Mingus shook his head.
His parents were among those who didn't want their kids to speak it. Now, of course, he's keen to learn. Speak of that.
He broke off abruptly, eyeing Roger with his head to one side.
I had a thought, after we spoke the other day. I wondered, just, would you maybe think of doing a wee class now and then? Maybe only for Jem's form, maybe a presentation for the school as a whole, if you felt comfortable about it. A class? What? In the Gaelic? Yes. You know, very basic stuff. But maybe with a word or two about the history. Maybe a bit of a song? Rob said you're choir master at St. Stephen's. Assistant, Roger corrected. And I don't know about the singing. But the Gaelic. Aye, maybe. I'll think about it.
He found Brianna waiting up in his study, a letter from her parents' box in her hand, unopened. We don't have to read it tonight, she said, putting it down, rising and coming to kiss him. I just felt like I wanted to be close to them. How was Lodge?
Odd.
The business of the Lodge was secret, of course, but he could tell her about Mingus and Cameron, and did.
What's the SNP? She asked, frowning. Scottish National Party.
He skinned out of his coat and shivered. It was cold, and there was no fire in the study.
Came in during the late 30s, but didn't really get going until quite recently. Elected 11 members to Parliament by 1974, though. Respectable. As you might gather from their name, their goal is Scottish independence.
Respectable, she repeated, sounding dubious.
Well, moderately. Like any party, they have their lunatic elements. For what it's worth, he added, I don't think Rob Cameron's one of them. Just your average asshole.
That made her laugh, and the sound of it warmed him. So did her body, which she pressed against his, arms round his shoulders.
That would be Rob, she agreed. Mingus says he's interested in the Gaelic, though. If I teach a class, I hope he doesn't turn up in the front row.
Wait. What? Now you're teaching Gaelic classes?
Well, maybe. We'll see about it.
He found himself reluctant to think too much about Mingus's suggestion. Maybe it was only the mention of singing. Croaking out a tune to guide the kids was one thing. Singing alone in public, even if it was only school kids, was something else again.
That couldn't wait, he said,
and kissed her.
Let's read your letter.
June 2nd, 1777. Fort Ticonderoga.
Fort
Ticonderoga?
Bree's voice rose in astonishment, and she all but jerked the letter from Roger's hands.
What on earth are they doing in Fort Ticonderoga?
I don't know, but if you'll settle for a moment, we'll maybe find out.
She didn't reply, but came round the desk and leaned over, her chin propped on his shoulder, her hair brushing his cheek as she focused anxiously on the page.
It's okay, he said, turning to kiss her cheek. It's your mum, and she's in an especially parenthetical mood. She doesn't normally do that unless she's feeling happy.
Well, yes, Bree murmured, frowning at the page. But Fort Ticonderoga?
Dear Bree, et al. As you've doubtless gathered from the heading of this letter, we are not yet in Scotland. We had a certain amount of difficulty on our voyage, involving A, the Royal Navy, in the person of one Captain Stebbings, who attempted to press your father and your cousin Ian. It didn't work. B, an American privateer, though her captain, one, and one of him is more than enough, Asa Hickman, insists upon the more dignified letter of marque as the designation of his ship's mission, which is essentially piracy, but executed under the authority of the Continental Congress. C. Rollo. And D. The gentleman I mentioned to you earlier named, I thought, John Smith, but who turns out to be a deserter from the Royal Navy named Bill, a.k.a. Jonah, and I begin to think they are right. Marsden. Without going into the details of the whole blood-soaked farce, I will merely report that Jamie, Ian, the damned dog, and I are all fine. So far. I'm hoping this state of affairs continues for the next 42 days, that being when your father's short-term militia contract expires. Don't ask. Essentially, he was saving Mr. Marsden's neck as well as providing for the welfare of a couple of dozen seamen inadvertently.